So welcome back. We are looking at chapter 24 in The Life Divine, The Evolution of the Spiritual Man. So evolution is a double process. It moves forward through externalized forms, yes, but more potently, the spirit in nature is evolving consciousness. And when we reach the level of humanity, the evolving consciousness seeks for the secret of existence, for itself, for the world, for what is beyond, through four primary movements. One, religion, another, occultism, a third, spiritual philosophy, and the fourth, and the greatest, of course, is spiritual experience and realization. So Sri Aurobindo has been describing the various stages of the religious development in humanity as one of the modes by which we come to know self, world, and the transcendent. So, in the early innings of religion, it is a lower vital province with which we're in contact. We are engaged with the spirits of nature. As we move beyond into a higher realm, as mentality becomes stronger in us, we become more aware of the subtle ranges of our own inner being, cognate with the worlds. We develop a recognition of this divine presence in numbers and numbers of beings, which could be not merely forces, but also personalities, which could be mythologized. But that isn't the end of it. Of course, religion continues to develop and wants to rationalize its experience, and in so doing, establishes a creedal basis to what its approach is. So this is where we've reached at the end of our last session, was where religion as a system of knowledge based on creed, nevertheless, has a point of origination where it is concentrated, and then a point of dispersion, you might say, where it casts its ideas out. So there can be a founding experience or insight based on a religious approach. But then it wants to be externalized. It wants to be broadcast. And it wants to grow. Of course, this leads to a kind of stabilization and also a generalization of an insight. But it becomes ossified at some point. It becomes rigid. So to balance the concentrated insight with dispersion, which is harmonious, is the challenge for religion. To keep the inner life and to bring in those who are outside into it so that they can experience it too. The next sentence. Thus came into being the religions which rely mainly or in the mass on creed and ritual for some spiritual result, but yet hold, because of their truth of experience, the fundamental inner reality that was initially present in them and persists so long as there are men to continue or renew it, a means for those who are touched by the spiritual impulse to realize the divine and liberate the spirit. So there is a core experience at the heart of religion. If it can be successfully communicated, the religion lives and continues to prosper. This development has led farther to a division into two tendencies, Catholic and Protestant. One, a tendency towards some conservation of the original plastic character of religion, its many-sidedness and appeal to the whole nature of the human being, the other, disruptive of this catholicity and insistent on a pure reliance on belief, worship, and conduct simplified so as to make a quick and ready appeal to the common reason, heart, and ethical will. This use of the word Catholic and Catholicity, of course, brings into mind the Christian Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church. But this could also have application in other religions, as in Islam, where the Sunni religion is the more exoteric, and the branch Shia, which contains Sufism, is more esoteric and based on mystical philosophy. So you have this polarity available in any approach, but he doesn't use these words accidentally, and you'll see in a moment they do have application to the West. This turn has tended to create an excessive rationalization, a discrediting and condemnation of most of the occult elements which seek to establish a communication with what is invisible, a reliance on the surface mind as the sufficient vehicle of the spiritual endeavor, a certain dryness and a narrowness and paucity of the spiritual life have been a frequent consequence. So this exoteric stress can suffocate a religion and deprive it of its inner moistness. Snigdha in Sanskrit. The word paucity, by the way, means fewness, small in number. This is an insight noted by other people, too, that despite the limitations of the Catholic religion, at least it has a sense of what is beyond nature, of a secret, a greater reality, where often when one contacts the Protestant religions, one has the sense of a firm discipline that must be followed, and just as he says here, reliance on creed, worship. Moreover, the intellect, having denied so much, cast out so much, has found ample room and opportunity to deny more until it denies all, to negate spiritual experience and cast out spirituality and religion, leaving only intellect itself as the sole surviving power. But intellect, void of the spirit, can only pile up external knowledge and machinery and efficiency and ends in a drying up of the secret springs of vitality and a decadence without any inner power to save the life or create a new life or any other way out than death and disintegration and a new beginning out of the old ignorance. This structure in religion, as it becomes exoteric and based on intellect only, the appeal to reason, is antithetical to everything that Sri Aurobindo found valuable. Remember, his philosophy is founded on the validity of experience, and experience is cast into an intellectually defensible form as a philosophy to give full expression, to allow the mind to share in the quest for the spirit. But experience, not philosophy, not intellect, is the bedrock. It would have been possible for the evolutionary principle to have preserved its pristine wholeness of movement while pressing on by an expansion and not a disruption of the wiser ancient harmony to a greater synthesis of the principle of concentration and the principle of diffusion. In India, we have seen there has been a persistence of the original intuition and total movement of evolutionary nature. So you see here clearly the above description with the limitations of religion applies to the West, and India is now offered in contradistinction to that. For religion in India limited itself by no one creed or dogma. It not only admitted a vast number of different formulations, but contained successfully within itself all the elements that have grown up in the course of the evolution of religion and refused to ban or excise any. It developed occultism to its utmost limits, accepted spiritual philosophies of all kinds, followed to its highest, deepest, or largest outcome every possible line of spiritual realization, spiritual experience, spiritual self-discipline. So here we have all the four means by which nature moves humanity towards a spiritually evolved being. Occultism, religion, spiritual philosophy, experience, all here, present and living in one corpus in India. Its method has been the method of evolutionary nature herself, to allow all developments, all means of communication and action of the spirit upon the members, all ways of communion between man and the supreme or divine, to follow every possible way of advance to the goal and test it even to its extreme. All stages of spiritual evolution are there in man, and each has to be allowed or provided with its means of approach to the spirit, an approach suited to its capacity, adhikara. The word means established above. It means thus one has authority, thus one has a right, one has the capacity. So according to your nature, according to your development, you find a path that's good for you. Even the primitive forms that survived were not banned, but were lifted to a deeper significance, while still there was the pressure to the highest spiritual pinnacles in the rarest supreme ether. Even the exclusive creedal type of religion was not itself excluded, provided its affinity to the general aim and principle was clear. It was admitted into the infinite variety of the general order. But this plasticity sought to support itself on a fixed religio-social system, which it permeated with the principle of a graded working out of the human nature, turned at its height towards a supreme spiritual endeavor. This social fixity, which was perhaps necessary at one time for unity of life, if not also as a settled and secure basis for the spiritual freedom, has been on one side a power for preservation, but also the one obstacle to the native spirit of entire Catholicity, an element of excessive crystallization and restriction. A fixed basis may be indispensable, but if settled in essence, this also must be in its forms capable of plasticity, evolutionary change. It must be an order, but a growing order. So, according to Dharma and Shastra, religions became ossified, became to some extent moribund, began to prevent the free development through these social structures which the West generally casts aspersions upon as the caste system. It had initially and originally a greater perspective and view, which Sri Aurobindo has detailed in other works, not so much here in The Life Divine, and we've talked about those on other Sunday evenings, so we won't dwell here now on it, but this is the allusion that he makes here. Nevertheless, The principle of this great and many-sided religious and spiritual evolution was sound, and by taking up in itself the whole of life and of human nature, by encouraging the growth of intellect and never opposing it or putting bounds to its freedom, but rather calling it in to the aid of the spiritual seeking, it prevented the conflict or the undue predominance which in the Occident led to the restriction and drying up of the religious instinct and the plunge into pure materialism and secularism. A very sharp insight. A method of this plastic and universal kind, admitting but exceeding all creeds and forms, and allowing every kind of element, may have numerous consequences which might be objected to by the purist. But its great justifying result has been an unexampled multitudinous richness and a more than millennial persistence and impregnable durability, generality, universality, height, subtlety, and many-sided wideness of spiritual attainment and seeking and endeavor. Yes, he is still writing about India's spiritual heritage and greatness. It is indeed only by such a catholicity and plasticity that the wider aim of the evolution can work itself out with any fullness. So you can derive from this that India has a special role to play in the world's culture, to drive home the truth of what is at the core of religion by dint of its plasticity, its catholicity, its richness, its refusal to say no to any style. You find an approach that works, we are in agreement with it. We may not select it for our own development, but we encourage you in your development. The individual demands from religion a door of opening into spiritual experience or a means of turning towards it, a communion with God, or a definite light of guidance on the way, a promise of the hereafter, or a means of a happier supra-terrestrial future. These needs can be met on the narrower basis of creedal belief and sectarian cult. But there is also the wider purpose of nature, to prepare and further the spiritual evolution in man and turn him into a spiritual being. Religion serves her as a means for pointing his effort and his ideal in that direction and providing each one who is ready with the possibility of taking a step upon the way towards it. This end she serves by the immense variety of the cults she has created, some final, standardized, and definitive, others more plastic, various, and many-sided. A religion which is itself a congeries of religions and which at the same time provides each man with his own turn of inner experience, would be the most in consonance with this purpose of nature. The word, by the way, means an aggregation. It would be a rich nursery of spiritual growth and flowering, a vast multiform school of the soul's discipline, endeavor, self-realization. Whatever errors religion has committed, this is her function and her great and indispensable utility and service, the holding up of this growing light of guidance on our way through the mind's ignorance towards the spirit's complete consciousness and self-knowledge. This finishes his treatment of religion here, but you can see again, religion, in his estimation, is at its best when it is a light carrying us, encouraging us towards a complete experience. That is what consciousness and self-knowledge reveal. So now, having done with religion, he turns to occultism. Occultism is, in its essence, man's effort to arrive at a knowledge of secret truths and potentialities of nature which will lift him out of slavery to his physical limits of being. An attempt, in particular, to possess and organize the mysterious, occult, outwardly still undeveloped direct power of mind upon life and of both mind and life over matter. There is, at the same time, an endeavor to establish communication with worlds and entities belonging to the superphysical heights, depths, and intermediate levels of cosmic being, and to utilize this communion for the mastery of a higher truth and for a help to man in his will to make himself sovereign over nature's powers and forces. So, occultism goes a step beyond contacting those things and beginning to wish to know all the corridors, all the labyrinthine passages, all the levels of being behind the superficies of nature, to know and to master the hidden universe. This human aspiration takes its stand on the belief, intuition, or intimation that we are not mere creatures of the mud, but souls, minds, wills that can know all the mysteries of this and every world and become not only nature's pupils, but her adepts and masters. The occultist sought to know the secret of physical things also, and in this effort he furthered astronomy, created chemistry, gave an impulse to other sciences, for he utilized geometry also and the science of numbers. But still more, he sought to know the secrets of supernature. So, astrology leads to astronomy. Alchemy leads to chemistry. Sacred geometry and mathematics leads to an explosion of knowledge in all sorts of fields where mathematics are applied. But still more, he sought to know the secrets of supernature, what is beyond the surfaces of nature. In this sense, he says, occultism might be described as the science of the supernatural, but it is in fact only the discovery of the superphysical, the surpassing of the material limit. The heart of occultism is not the impossible chimera which hopes to go beyond or outside all force of nature and make pure fantasy and arbitrary miracle omnipotently effective. What seems to us supernatural is in fact either a spontaneous eruption of the phenomena of other nature into physical nature, or in the work of the occultist, a possession of the knowledge and power of the higher orders or grades of cosmic being and energy, and the direction of their forces and processes towards the production of effects in the physical world by seizing on possibilities of interconnection and means for a material effectuality. In other words, to come into contact with all the many forces in mind and life behind the scene, and coming to know them, then applying that knowledge until one has mastery and imposing it upon the physical. A chimera, of course, means she-goat from the Greek. It's a fabulous monster. Fabulous. And eruption, unlike eruption, which is throwing out, is a breaking or a bursting in other words, getting into the interior part of nature. There are powers, he writes, of the mind and the life force which have not been included in nature's present systematization of mind and life and matter, but are potential and can be brought to bear upon material things and happenings, or even brought in and added to the present systematization so as to enlarge the control of mind over our own life and body, or to act on the minds, lives, bodies of others, or on the movements of cosmic forces. So, to control not only oneself, but when necessary, when desirable, to control the influences and actions of others, to even command the cosmic forces. This is all within the purview of the practicing occultist. The modern admission of hypnotism is an example of such a discovery and systematized application, though still narrow and limited by its method and formula, of occult powers, which otherwise touch us only by a casual or a hidden action whose process is unknown to us or perfectly or imperfectly caught by a few. For we are all the time undergoing a battery of suggestions, thought suggestions, impulse suggestions, will suggestions, emotional and sensational suggestions, thought waves, life waves that come on us or into us from others or from the universal energy, but act and produce their effects without our knowledge. So first recognize and then master. And you see here again something that is a direct extension from his own experience, his first great yogic realization of Brahmic Nirvana was this, to recognize at the beginning that there are forces of thought that come swirling into us from a mind ocean outside. We think they originate in us, they really come in from outside. Or you can think of them as being telegraphically sent, and here we are receiving them. We receive and transmit to paper what is sent over the telegraph, and that is the crude apparatus by which we come to know it. A systematized endeavor to know these movements and their law and possibilities, to master and use the power or nature force behind them, or to protect ourselves from them, would fall within one province of occultism, but it would only be a small part even of that province, for wide and multiple are the possible fields, uses, processes of this vast range of little explored knowledge. And see, he capitalizes knowledge here. So he has respect for this field of exploration behind the crust of the physical. Occult, again, simply means hidden. It doesn't mean spooky. It means what is hidden to the externalized view. That we should be able to explore, to come to know, to come to master, and to apply those forces and that knowledge in our lives. It should not be a taboo. In modern times, as physical science enlarged its discoveries and released the secret material forces of nature into an action governed by human knowledge for human use, occultism receded and was finally set aside on the ground that the physical alone is real and mind and life are only departmental activities of matter. On this basis, believe in material energy to be the key of all things. Science has attempted to move towards a control of mind and life processes, pardon me, by a knowledge of the material instrumentation and process of our normal and abnormal mind and life functionings and activities. The spiritual is ignored as only one form of mentality. So this is the impact of science upon occultism, that it has reversed the order of control from the without to the within. We try to control and understand our internal processes through an explanation that has a material basis. It may be observed in passing that if this endeavor succeeded, it might not be without danger for the existence of the human race, even as now are certain other scientific discoveries misused or clumsily used by a humanity mentally and morally unready for the handling of powers so great and perilous. For it would be an artificial control applied without any knowledge of the secret forces which underlie and sustain our existence. In other words, material powers unleashed and thought to be merely material and thus exploitable can bring us to ruin. Occultism in the West could be thus easily pushed aside because it never reached its majority, and here the word means preeminence or coming to full age. Never acquired ripeness and a philosophic or sound systematic foundation. It indulged too freely in the romance of the supernatural, or made the mistake of concentrating its major effort on the discovery of formulas and effective modes for using supernormal powers. It deviated into magic, white and black, or into a romantic or thaumaturgic paraphernalia of occult mysticism and the exaggeration of what was, after all, a limited and scanty knowledge. Thaumaturgic means wonder-working. So, in the West, in the Occident, we had very little knowledge to begin with and misused it. These tendencies, he says, and this insecurity of mental foundation made it difficult to defend and easy to discredit, a target facile and vulnerable. In Egypt and the East, this line of knowledge arrived at a greater and more comprehensive endeavor. This ampler maturity can be seen still intact in the remarkable system of the Tantras. It was not only a many-sided science of the supernormal, but supplied the basis of all the occult elements of religion and even developed a great and powerful system of spiritual discipline and self-realization. For the highest occultism is that which discovers the secret movements and dynamic supernormal possibilities of mind and life and spirit and uses them in their native force or by an applied process for the greater effectivity of our mental, vital, and spiritual being. This is absolutely true of the Tantras and their origin and their continuation for a long time, and still is vibrantly found in the Sri Vidya tradition in India. By the way, if I could make a comment here on something he touches. For the highest occultism is that which discovers the secret movements and uses them in their native force, etc. Sri Aurobindo did not himself require elaborate training. It was through his inner movement, the exploration of his inner consciousness and of the world inwardly, that delivered to him the powers and the siddhis which are associated with the end of all occultism. So he acquired these naturally. He did not require a teacher. He discovered and governed. Occultism is associated in popular idea with magic and magical formulae and a supposed mechanism of the supernatural. But this is only one side. Nor is it altogether a superstition, as is vainly imagined by those who have not looked deeply or at all at this covert side of secret nature force or experimented with its possibilities. Formulas and their application. A mechanization of latent forces can be astonishingly effective in the occult use of mind power and life power, just as it is in physical science. But this is only a subordinate method and a limited direction. For mind and life forces are plastic, subtle, and variable in their action and have not the material rigidity. They need a subtle and plastic intuition in the knowledge of them, in the interpretation of their action and process, and in their application, even in the interpretation and action of their established formulas. Again, his was a spontaneous touch born of realized mastery, but mastery attained through practice, and one can read in what is extant in his record of yoga, how it was that he developed and extended these discoveries and these practices. An overstress on mechanization and rigid formulation is likely to result in sterilization or a formalized limitation of knowledge, and on the pragmatic side, to much error, ignorant convention, misuse, and failure. Now that we are outgrowing the superstition of the sole truth of matter, a swing backward towards the old occultism and to new formulations, as well as to a scientific investigation of the still hidden secrets and powers of mind, and a close study of psychic and abnormal or supernormal psychological phenomena is possible and in parts already visible. But if it is to fulfill itself, the true foundation, the true aim and direction, the necessary restrictions and precautions of this line of inquiry have to be rediscovered. Its most important aim must be the discovery of the hidden truths and powers of the mind force and the life force, and the greater forces of the concealed spirit. Occult science is, essentially, the science of the subliminal in ourselves, and the subliminal in world nature, and of all that is in connection with the subliminal, including the subconscient and the superconscient, and the use of it as part of self-knowledge and world knowledge, and for the right dynamization of that knowledge. So the subliminal, again, to Sri Aurobindo, is going to mean behind the line. He's using this as sort of the wall that separates outer nature from inner nature, not as above and below. There's no perfect word to describe it in his language, so he had to commandeer subliminal to his purpose on this. So, self-knowledge, world knowledge, and right dynamization of that knowledge. This is the goal of occult science. This should be its largest mission. So, he's treated occultism now, and we move on to spiritual philosophy next time. We'll put our bookmarks here. Turn to Savitri, as we like to do. Tonight we move to Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. A thousand baffling faces of the truth looked at him from her forms with unknown eyes, and wordless mouths unrecognizable, spoke from the figures of her masquerade, or peered from the recondite magnificence and subtle splendor of her draperies. In sudden scintillations of the unknown, inexpressive sounds became veridical. Ideas that seemed unmeaning flashed out truth, voices that came from unseen waiting worlds, uttered the syllables of the unmanifest to clothe the body of the mystic word, and wizard diagrams of the occult law sealed some precise, unreadable harmony, or used hue and figure to reconstitute the herald blazon of time's secret things. In her green wildernesses and lurking depths, in her thickets of joy where danger clasps delight, he glimpsed the hidden wings of her songster hopes, a glimmer of blue and gold and scarlet fire. In her covered lanes, bordering her chance field paths, and by her singing rivulets and calm lakes, he found the glow of her golden fruits of bliss and the beauty of her flowers of dream and muse. As if a miracle of hearts changed by joy, he watched in the alchemist radiance of her suns the crimson outburst of one secular flower on the tree of sacrifice of spiritual love. In the sleepy splendor of her noons he saw a perpetual repetition through the hours, thought's dance of dragonflies on mystery stream that skim but never test its murmurs race, and heard the laughter of her rose desires, running as if to escape from longed-for hands, jingling sweet anklet bells of fantasy. Amidst live symbols of her occult power, he moved and felt them as close, real forms. In that life, more concrete than the lives of men, throbbed heartbeats of the hidden reality. Embodied was there what we but think and feel, self-framed what here takes outward borrowed shapes. A comrade of silence on her austere heights, accepted by her mighty loneliness, he stood with her on meditating peaks, where life and being are a sacrament offered to the reality beyond, and saw her loose into infinity, her hooded eagles of significance, messengers of thought to the unknowable. Identified in soul vision and soul sense, entering into her depths as into a house, all he became that she was or longed to be. He thought with her thoughts and journeyed with her steps, lived with her breath and scanned all with her eyes, that so he might learn the secret of her soul. A nice point to pause. And I raise my paws in salutation to you. Jai Ma, Namaste.